Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research Radio Program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, August 9th, 2013. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Jim McCarty is Carla's husband, the scribe for the Ra Contact, and president of LL Research. Please visit our websites, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And the community website, bringforth.org, that's bring, the number four, th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I'll be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Hi, Carla and Jim. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
Doing just fine. How are you, Monica?
I'm doing great. Another busy week, but
well,
can't complain.
Aren't they all?
Get all ready for the homecoming, and golly, Jim just started washing the windows today. You know, we do our home our spring cleaning before homecoming instead of in the spring because there are so many people in the house. Then we think, well, if we're ever going to be clean for company, we might as well do it now.
Well, sounds like you got your work cut out for you, so it's coming up in. What, just three weeks,
right?
It's not
a real
weeks,
big
right?
house, you know, but it's just making sure that when people wander about the house and poke in whatever corners people poke into, and they do, it's a miraculous what they, and believe me, if there was anything to find, they'd find it, you know, so we just don't want any surprises.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
No dust bunnies,
okay.
You know.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just I think it's that age-old woman. Sorry, I guess the woman's thing, or it used to be a woman's thing. I would think it would be any host or hostess wants to have a clean house.
Well, of course. That's natural.
Yeah.
Sure.
So,
you get excited
here,
about the
just event? Jim stapling the questions. We're running a little close this week.
Running a little close with what now?
Carla was saying that sound you heard was me stapling the questions. We were running kind of close to getting them ready.
I missed them. You know, and so you just resent them. And so, I just didn't look. Like an idiot.
Okay, well, I'm glad you got them now. So,
yeah.
Okay. Did you have any other quick announcements about anything?
I don't. Do you, Jim?
Nope. Not a one.
No, we're still in a waiting mode as far as what's going to happen with this final surgery that will close me up for good and get me on the healing track. I can't wait. I want to see the doctor next week, and hopefully he'll say everything's good to go and schedule that skin graft, and we'll be off and running.
Okay, good.
The way I'm imaging it, you know, I'm doing my affirmation that this will be the way it happens.
Let us know when that happens so we can all be praying for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, our opening riff is from session 30.4. Questioner, is there any loss to the mind or spirit after this transition, which we call death, or any impairment of either because of the loss of this chemical body that we now have? I am Ra. In your terms, there is a great loss of mind complex due to the fact that much of the activity of a mental nature of which you are aware during the experience of this space-time continuum is as much of a surface illusion as is the chemical body complex. In other terms, nothing whatever of importance is lost. The character, or shall we say, pure distillation of emotions and biases or distortions and wisdoms, if you will, becoming obvious for the first time, shall we say. These pure emotions and wisdoms and biased distortions being, for the most part, either ignored or underestimated during physical life experience.
Thank you, Monica. I picked this out because I think this is one of the more challenging things that Ra offers us in terms of who we are, who we really are. When we think of that, who we are, we try to go beyond the surface. We realize that we're not a certain age or a certain sex. We're not a certain station in life. We're not a certain profession or whatever it is that we do, whether it's motherhood or running a country or waitressing or corporative life or anything. That isn't it. So what is it? So you go a few layers down and you begin finding the things about you that don't go away. There's a certain feeling that you normally wake up with, and you carry it throughout your days, regardless of what you're doing, is unmistakably you. It's the ground from which everything springs, all of your actions, all of your emotions. All of your thoughts. What is that ground? How have you altered the consciousness that comes into you and flows through you? Biases are a really important thing to look at, because biases are not wrong. They are the wisdom that you have come to from long and hard experience. Whether you're 6 or 16 or 66, it doesn't matter. There's a tremendous amount of experience in one little day in life. Moment to moment to moment, you gain wisdom, and then you test it, and there's a process that moves through you because you remember what you preferred and what you didn't prefer. And as you test these things and repeat those experiences, it's all of life is not as simple as touching a hot stove and recoiling because it hurts. Okay, you know that that hurts, and you stay away from something that's hot enough to burn you. for the most part. That's learned early. But what else burns in your life? What else causes you to avoid, to distance yourself, to remove? And towards what brightness and beauty do you lean? Do you move? Do you yearn? As those of Ra suggested, you may not take those preferences too seriously. And yet, they are the distillation of your experience. That towards which you yearn, that which you find beautiful and good and true, is it always that way? Is it trustworthy? You ask yourself that, perhaps without meaning to, about everyone you meet. If you interact with them on any level, they begin to be those things towards which you yearn or away from which you make at least psychic distance. And at the end of your life, however long it is, and however many experiences that you've had, what is true and real about you in a way that will never go away is this set of biases, these hard-won wisdoms, these preferences, if you will, or in some cases, these addictions. If you have continued moving towards that beauty that you love, with any success in life, you will have begun to shape your environment to suit yourself, so that you find more reasons to smile than you do to frown, more reasons to rejoice than you do to grieve, more times to thank the Lord than to pray, "Help me, I'm in trouble." When I look at my own life, I am deeply, deeply satisfied, because I am allowed to move towards beauty every single breath I take. There is nothing in the way of that beauty, that sunshine of my soul. My devotion towards the Creator takes the shape of Jesus, the Son of Man, as he called himself, and I give thanks every day that I opened my heart at a very young age to somebody, some essence of love that was so beautiful to me that I yearned for it every day of my life. The man that I wake up with in the morning and go to sleep with at night is a man I admire more than I admire almost anyone. I am so grateful that this is the shape of my life. And I ask each of you to find your sunshine, to yearn for it, to move towards it, to embrace it and give thanks for it. Whatever it is the most important thing about you. Treasure it. Give it meaning. Honor it. May you always have sunshine in your life, dear ones. Amen.
Thank you, Carla. You know, what I'm hearing you say is that there's so much more to our being, to our very essence, than what we see on the surface, and to really reach for that. And yet, I have to say, I when I read that passage from Ra, the first time I read it, and even now, after having read it so many times over the years, I still do find it a little bit disconcerting, because even though we're all reaching for that fullness of awareness and consciousness, realistically, many of us aren't quite there yet. We still are identifying quite a bit with our mental body complex. And in that, so in that sense, the idea of losing that upon the death of the physical body is rather disconcerting, because I mean, there's so much to our personality, you know, the kind of music we like, our the things we enjoy in life, just personality, the thought processes, to think that all of that will be lost is rather disconcerting to me. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I guess in a way I value that part of myself. I think I'm a clever person. I enjoy my own company. And certainly I think that, you know, my taste in music is good, and I love so many things. But I wonder if the important thing, the thing that holds for eternity, is the music or our reaction to it. Our appreciation of it, our loving it. You know, I have listened to some pieces of music, and this crosses all genres, so many times I know them so well, you know. And yet I have a feeling that the important thing about that well-honed love is the purity of that love rather than the outward shape of it. If I were to want to put something in my incarnational bag and take it with me forever, it would be Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. I loved it so much. I've danced to it. I've hummed it. I've listened to it. You know, it's been in my life for so long. I can remember when I was a senior in high school, my class got to go to a concert, and that was what was playing. And I thought, I'm the luckiest person in the world. I got to hear Beethoven's Seventh, my favorite. And yet, is it the music? Or is it the intensity and purity of my love that truly was the creation of wisdom in that experience? Do I have to carry the form of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in order to carry the appreciation that has grown to such an extent that it is just like a jewel in my heart. I mean, I think I do carry that. Do I need to carry the outward shape of the music? Do I need to carry my thought processes? Or is it that from which my thought processes spring that's important? I think you could, this is one of those things you could talk about all day. And you know, at the end of the day, every single piece of music that you ever reacted to would still be unique, you know. And there are so many unique and beautiful creations just in music. I mean, not talking about all the other beautiful things, natural and man-made, that we can appreciate in this life. You know, it's incredible how many things there are to appreciate and see and honor the beauty of. But what truly lasts? What is the lasting thing? Is it just my ability to hear those things with my human ears? Or is it the wisdom that appreciates at such a deep level?
Well, that's precisely really my question. Go ahead.
I said that's really, you know, is what has developed over the years is the depth and purity of my appreciation, maybe the intensity. You know, it's been years in the making. And when I hear something new, it's just the start, you know, and I want to hear it again and hear it again and hear it again until it's so known to me that it's within me. And then I can't lose it, you know, because it's there and it's appreciated. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that, let's put it this way. What we bring into this life is a set of biases that have withstood many incarnations. And here we are. This is who we are. And we move out into life and things begin to affect us. And at the end of this life, hopefully, there are many things that we have found to love that have deepened our appreciation of whatever it is that we're loving. And when we carry it out again, do we want the welter of day-to-day experiences, or is it enough to have the distillation of those experiences in our ability to hold love, beauty, truth, and honor them? You know, how do we hope that we've improved ourselves by the time that we bid this incarnation farewell and move to our next experience of life in the physical? Would you hope to carry a remembrance that you need to go back and look up Beethoven's Seventh? Or are you content with remembering the utter beauty that you have found in music?
Well, why do we have to choose, though? I guess that's my question. Why can't we have both? I mean, I understand what you're saying about what's enduring, but my question is, why is anything lost? I mean, just looking at this single lifetime, I look back at my photo album from 20 years ago when my son was little, and there's snapshots in time. If I didn't have those particular pictures, I would have lost those memories. There were moments of joy and you know, experiences that we had that are lost. And I know that
the
lessons we learned.
You know, you've
true.
Perhaps lost to the fact that there's just so much you can store in your memory, and then it starts to go into archives because there's too much. There's just too much, you know. And I think that maybe one of the reasons that older folks start to forget things is that they're full. And just about everything simply strikes them and then bounces back off again, because it's another day-to-day detail that has not penetrated this shell and has not gone down into that which is real about us. So I think that, you know, the way memory works is we seem to lose it little by little throughout our incarnation. So very distinct memories become vague but golden memories. And, you know, we remember the joy that we had, but not necessarily the details. And you say, why not have every single detail? Well, I have a feeling that we drown in detail. And what we're looking for in terms of depth of character, as in terms of who we really are, we're looking for things that have crystallized within us and that take no room whatsoever, but they make us more vulnerable to beauty, more vulnerable to joy. And I think that in the end, that's what I value more than anything else, is I think I have gained a capacity to love and appreciate on a very deep level, because I know just how important these things are. And things that I have found important in this life are relationships. Nothing has ever seemed as important to me, as vivid to me, as real to me, as the people in my life. And those with whom I'm intimate, and by that I don't simply mean sexually intimate, I mean intimate the way you are when your souls mingle, you know? When there comes a moment that you trust each other so much and have loved each other so long that you are totally open to each other and truly intimate with each other. And I think I value that hard-won capacity more than the details of how I got it. Not that I don't appreciate the details, but I do find that they soften with age and lose detail and gain in, I don't know, patina, shimmer, you know. There's a golden shimmer around older memories. And, you know, gradually you forget just exactly what somebody looks like at a certain age, you know. But you remember the joy that you took in their friendship. And that doesn't go away. And I think that's what we take. Why not take it all? Well, how many incarnations have we had? How much detail do you want to carry?
Well, let me give an analogy. The internet. You can get on the internet and look up anything you want. Just do a search on, you know, gardening or home furnishing or shopping or whatever you want, and you can access any information you want anytime. And the information is there. It's accessible. And you don't necessarily want to clutter your mind with all of the information all at once. That would be ridiculous. But yet you can access it anytime you want. So
yeah.
That's what I'm wondering, because, like, for example, I've had glimpses of a few past lives. And part of me is just curious. There was a while when I first remembered that one particular past lifetime, I got kind of obsessed about it, trying to dig it up and you know, recapture some of it. And I got what I needed, and then I let it go.
Uh-huh.
And what I needed was to forgive a certain person, et cetera, et cetera. So I understand all that, and I totally agree with everything you're saying about the more enduring qualities being more important. But yet, why not
you
have
that
memory?
You want to be able to access the rest of it.
Exactly.
I wonder
if I just feel like accessing... What's that?
I said, I wonder if we can at some level. The rise,
well, that's my question.
Because modern physics does. modern physics.
I don't mind it not being there all the time, but
yeah.
but it's a little disconcerting to think that it's lost. I mean, how can this person that I once was be lost? You know, that person in that other lifetime is just gone. That personality, what she liked, what she did throughout the day, it's just gone.
Well, you know, it may not be gone, and I could talk about that, but I haven't heard a word from Jim, and I'm interested in what you think, Nick.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. I think it's natural to be disconcerted about thinking of what you're going to lose when you die, and we're just going to have to live with that for a while. Like most of the truths that we're seeking as seekers of truth, all of this stuff does reside within us. We come from it, so we know it well, but we've consciously forgotten it, so we can come here and become individualized in a certain way that allows us to seek the Creator and allows the Creator to gain further experience. So as we enter the death process, for a moment, it might be disconcerting. Then all of a sudden, we remember why we were here and what we're doing and who we are, who we really are, and what we just did and what it means to us. And it's like coming home. And the best analogy I can make for myself is when I was a kid in grade school, I go to the movies every Saturday night because it was right across the street from the grocery store my mom and dad worked at, and that was my babysitter was the movies. And I would get so engrossed in what was going on the screen, everything that was going on for the hero, I was experiencing. And it was a lot of turmoil and tumult and things. I just got so involved. And the movie was over, and I'd walk outside, and I'd say, oh, man, great. I'm glad that was just a movie, you know. Now I'm going to take up my real life. And I think it's going to be something like that, that for a moment we'll be disconcerted, but then we'll see the rightness of it all. It'll be just like going home, and all will be well. And maybe like Carla said, maybe there is a way, if we really wanted to, we could recall those things. But I have a hunch we may not want to. There may be other things that are more important, things that would make more sense to us in our total beingness, which we once again have access to. We're not just this little character here that played out a life and learned certain lessons because of it.
Well, that I kind of like that analogy to a point, but yet the characters in the movie on the screen that you were watching, you were not experiencing that from their perspective. You know, you were observing them. What I'm talking about is
I was the character
from your.
He was saying that he lost.
Well, but you lost the observer. Yeah.
And then he was there, and it was a whole different set of details.
It was very emotional. It tore me up. When it was that type of a movie.
When it was a sad movie, he was just really so glad that it wasn't, he didn't have to live with it the whole time because he had gotten, oh no. Yeah, he's told me this before, so I think I understand him. And he really had empathized to the point where he didn't have any boundaries. That was it. You know, that was his life. And he was one of the characters, whichever one he was identifying with. It was probably very disconcerting. And his parents would have been very disconcerted to have known that he would lose so much identity and take on, you know, the movie. And they probably want to, now, Jim, that's just a movie, you know. Yeah, I know. But it wouldn't help because the next time he'd get just as involved. And he was just that kind of a kid. He was so inner that, you know, he didn't share much. It took him a long time to start sharing anything.
For the length of the movie, I was no longer me. I was on the screen.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought.
Well, must have been a good movie,
huh? I have the feeling that in every single incarnation we've been in, there are these details that we love so much that we would hate to lose them. And yet, maybe we can only carry the essence, so we can't carry the detail. I don't know. But I was just going to say that modern physics says that anything that's happened goes on forever. Any time that we speak, any time that we connect with another person, that connection goes on forever, even when we don't realize we've made the connection, even if it's just in the grocery store or through the drive-in. Getting something, you know, at the drugstore or at a fast food. And if string theory is correct, in a way, all the details really are all out there. And it's just like even the older versions of the net are available because people have gone and started saving them. So that, like, I've been shown versions of LNL research that haven't been up on our active screens for years. But if you know where to look, they're still available on some place that specializes in outdated or archived websites. So maybe we're like that. Maybe our each life is archived in some vast library. Isn't that supposed to have been so, that there is a... What did that wonderful song Jim call it, that very deep, gravelly voice guy says, you know, well, people could say it wasn't real, but it was real to me.
Oh, Black Oak, Arkansas.
Yeah.
Was singing about his...
oh, wow.
And what
Nirvana experience, walking through the halls of karma.
Halls of karma, that's what he called it. Maybe there is a halls of karma where each and every detail is there forever and can be accessed if you know how to do it, which I don't. But
well, isn't that the Akashic Records? Isn't that what that is?
Yeah, like the Akashic Record. But in terms of what we carry, in terms of what our soul stream finds to be the essence of us, I don't think we carry the details. I think we carry what we've gleaned from it, the wisdom we've gleaned, the love that we've gleaned. And I think love is so important. And that, I think, is probably what gets undervalued by us more than anything else, is just as we go through life, deepening our capacity to love, which makes even difficult emotions like grief valuable, because even in grief, you're learning more deeply and more fully how to love. And that love that contains all things, you know, gradually starts becoming more like the Creator's love, because it encompasses all of the details, both the happy ones and the sad ones. I don't know, but we're doing it again. We're using up the whole hour talking about the first question.
Oh, we're not even on the first question. This is just the riff.
That's right. We're not even on the one, number one. This is before number one.
Okay, one last follow-up.
Okay.
I think you said something very, very... what am I trying to say? Okay, the emotions. I don't know. I lost it. But anyway, if you think back, if you think of the memories that you do have, the memories that feel like yesterday, even though it was 20 or 30 years ago, they tend to be the ones that had an intense emotion associated with them. So like you were, you know, either extreme joy or extreme grief or whatever, you really remember that moment. It's like a snapshot in time. And a lot of times when people have past life memories, they don't remember like the whole lifetime from start to finish. They just remember a snapshot in time. And why? Because in that moment, the emotion was so intense that you were fully present in that experience. So my theory is that as you become more mindful, more living in the present moment, you know, moment by moment, my theory is that we would start retaining more of these memories. Like we retain the ones that we were fully present in.
Yes, I love that thought.
You know, there are some people who remember everything that's ever happened in this life, every part of every day.
Really?
It's called perfect memory. It's much more than photographic memory. They actually remember everything that ever happened. You can ask them, well, where were you on this date, you know, maybe 20 years ago, 10 in the morning, they can tell you.
Wow.
And it just comes to them. They don't have to think about it. It's just
there. Wow. I'd never heard of that. I mean, I knew some people had photographic memory, but I've never heard of somebody remembering everything. I mean, is this like savants who can memorize, you know, they just memorize
the
whole
phone? No, it's ordinary people. Ordinary people
really?
Who may not have any spiritual tendency at all. It just is something that is a gift, I guess you'd say, just the way they are. But there are there's a small group of them. I mean, there's a few of them around. They're being researched, you know, of course.
Interesting. Okay, I guess we're ready to go to the first question. This is from, now I don't know how to say this, Kaluhai, maybe? Dear Monica, dear Carla, thanks for providing this opportunity to get into a more direct contact through answering specific questions. I am new to the raw material. I read the Seth books in the 80s, familiarized myself since with other sources such as Kryon, Aaron, and Bashar. Over the last 2 years, I reviewed several hundred Bashar, is that how you say it? Bashar videos. I tried to combine.
I guess Bashar.
Okay. I tried to combine his messages about parallel realities with some of the not yet mainstream approaches of physical science, in particular Bohm and Pribram's theories about the holographic character of the universe. It's all a projection. There is a comment by Bashar on Michael. There is a comment by Bashar on Ra on YouTube. Aaron mentions Ra. And there's a short comment by Kryon on Seth. My question is about the interrelationship of the various sources. Do they each know each other? Are they in contact with one another? Do they provide for consistency of their messages? Is there a timeline for disclosing the truth, e.g. to the extent it can be processed and intellectually digested? A second question is more concrete. There's a lot of material on an alleged Apollo 20 mission on the net, including footage of an alien body found in a derelict spaceship on the moon. Did this mission happen, or is it part of a comprehensive disinfo campaign? Thank you very much. From Kaluhai.
Kaluhui.
Okay.
Mickey, do you know anything about the second question? Because we can move that out of the way. If you don't, I don't, for sure.
Astronaut Edgar Mitchell was the one, yeah. He's written a book called Psychic Explorations, right above Carl on the bookshelf. And apparently he's gotten into paranormal research after his experience going to the moon. And he apparently said something at one conference about they ran into extraterrestrials there, and they were told in no uncertain terms not to come back to the moon. And that's the only explanation I've ever heard that makes any sense as to why we never did go back to the moon. I mean, why haven't we done something else besides, you know, I mean, we gave it up years ago. It took us 10 years to get there, and then we gave it up. Anyway, that's what I've heard from Edgar Mitchell.
I don't know anything about that. So I honestly have no opinion. But as to the first question, my only direct experience of this is when I sat with Barbara Brodsky to do the 9 weekends of sessions that turned into the Aaron Kuo dialogues years later, turned into a book. So it's available out there. And you can see in the book the joy that they take in each other's company. It did not seem as if they knew each other before. It seemed more as though they were having a wonderful time working together. And they were exultant about it. They were rejoicing in the chance that they were getting because of the two of us to be with each other and to work with each other and to talk back and forth. So I didn't get the impression then that they were in contact with each other. My opinion, and this may not be a comfortable opinion, is that each and every channel is a version of the truth that is possible because the channel and that entity from the outside of us somewhere in other realms is of a congruent nature so that we can make a good contact and we can get information. I get the impression that if somebody else, for instance, channeled Kuo or channeled Ra, it would be a different entity. It wouldn't be the same entity. It would be something that called itself a name, and they could call them whatever they wanted. But it wouldn't be the same as another person unless the two people that were channeling that entity were also of a congruent nature, which is unlikely. I think that there are good sources of information in so many different vibrations from the realms above our own. And when we are tuned to the highest and best that we are, we open to sources of information that want to talk with us. We have attracted those that are that are congruent with our desire. So I don't think that it's like there is one realm that everybody is in that's a static realm like it is here on Earth. I think that various entities are from various levels of consciousness, and their vibrations have different characteristics depending on the channel that they're working with. So if they get if you get a channel that is of a certain type, then the source that he finds is going to be one which is congruent with him. So I think that rather than there being like one Michael and various people having access to him through the years, that there is undoubtedly a number of entities, all of whom, for one reason or another, call themselves Michael. And, you know, I don't know if what I'm saying is making any sense at all. I hope so. But I think that the information from various sources is heavily dependent upon the nature of the relationship between that channel and that source. So it is doubtful that they know each other, I think. It is much more likely that they are a part of, a portion of, that entity that has made good contact with the channel. Does this make sense? Is this totally not making sense?
I think it does.
Very good with a follow-up path. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah. I actually don't have a follow-up. Do you, Jim?
No, I don't.
Well.
So, you make sense?
Okay.
You make sense, Carla?
Well, I'm very glad.
It's good to know that after all this time.
Okay, we got time for one more question, and this is from Mark Rammer. What is an adept?
Oh, yes.
He has a couple of follow-ups, I just realized. Okay, what is an adept? What is magic? And I exhibit a great deal of manifestation via faith in the Creator. Would I be considered a magic maker or a wizard?
Jim, why don't you take this one and talk about magic?
Well, I believe in adept, first of all.
If there's anything left over, I will talk about adepts.
Okay. Well, I'll give a quick explanation of adept from my point of view, and that would be a person who has attempted to know the self and has had a fair amount of success through some particular discipline. And this all leads to what Ra calls the disciplines of the personality. And when you discover more of what your personality is really made of as you go up or down, however you want to look at it, the tree of the mind, and discover that you are connected to a group mind and a racial mind, a planetary mind, an archetypical mind, and the universal mind, you start traveling that path, and you discover that the way things really are responds more to your desires and your thoughts and your construction than you ever thought was possible. Magic, as far as the classic definition, is the conscious ability to create changes in consciousness. And Ra changed that just a little bit. It actually gave a more basic definition. That was the unconscious, the ability to consciously use the subconscious mind, which I just described, all those various minds. So you're discovering your identity more and more, and what goes with that identity, which is the ability to create your experience, to be the creator, to discover you are the creator, you are a co-creator. That's it.
Okay. What I found when I searched for adepthood was that Ra uses this mostly in the latter part of the four books, especially book four, in talking about the tarot images. Don was asking about those who were seeking the magical personality. And I think adepthood is another word for magician, or one who has the ability to make changes in consciousness by thought alone. That's the adept. And the adept is a synonym of magical personality, the magical personality.
Okay. I don't know if I have anything to follow up on that. Is there anything else either you want to say on that?
Where Ra says what an adept is, he says the adept lives more and more as it is, which indicates that the nature of the magician is that it is more and more focused on consciousness itself and its relationship with the creator. The adept, when it's seeking, for instance, begins to do less of the preliminary or outer work having to do with function and begins to affect the inner work, which has to do with being. As the adept becomes a more and more consciously crystallized entity, it gradually manifests more and more of that which it has always been since before time, that is, the one infinite creator. So, Mick, do you have anything to say to that?
That's basically what I was trying to say before. And as far as the last part of this question, I exhibit a great deal of manifestation via faith in the Creator. Would I be considered a magic maker or wizard? Well, I think a magician would be a good term, or you've achieved somewhat the magic personality. Wizard is kind of a term that's, I don't know if it's accurately described. I wouldn't really want to. I think you're much more than a wizard. Somebody who has discovered something to do with the higher self and the power of the Creator.
So someone could be an adept and not necessarily be doing any sort of, ritual magic or anything like that. It could be simply that they're really consciously working on self.
Right.
Right.
Ra mentioned that many sixth density wanderers, for example, choose not to exhibit any form of manifestation of having activated the indigo ray, but really concentrate on being and learning and serving and so forth. They don't, you might say they don't do any tricks, they don't levitate, or they don't heal, they're not psychic.
Yeah, because when people think of the term adept or magic maker, wizard, that sort of thing, they usually think of, being able to do the parlor tricks, or being psychic or being being able to levitate and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah,
so
well, he doesn't say what he's manifesting. If he's manifesting healings, then you know most people would call him a healer. But here, perhaps this is the clearest idea that Ra offers on adepthood. He says the penetration of the veil may be seen to begin to have its roots in the gestation of green ray activity, that is, all compassionate love which demands no return. If this path is followed, the higher energy center shall be activated and crystallized until the adept is born. Within the adept is the potential for dismantling the veil to a greater or lesser extent that all may be seen again as one.
Don had kind of a joke he would tell. He'd say a third-rate adept or magician is one who can't levitate and doesn't. The second-rate magician or adept is one who says he can levitate and does. The first-rate adept is one who can levitate but doesn't.
It doesn't bother.
I have to think about that one. Not quite sure what his rationale was on that.
I think he was trying to point out the razzle dazzle of making magic is not the spiritual adept's concern. The spiritual adept's concern is to become the creator.
Okay.
And once you do that, all these other things are added. But they're not important. And when people focus on them as being important, then they're missing the point of what is important.
Okay. All right, that makes sense. Okay, we are out of time. So we're actually going to end on time today. Amazing. We usually go over a minute or a couple of minutes.
You get to read the whole outro.
I guess I'll read the whole outro this time. Okay. Thanks so much, Carl and Jim. It's always an honor to be working with you. I appreciate it. Appreciate all your words of wisdom. Okay, you've been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Record and Jim McCarty. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit LLresearch.org, which is the archive website featuring the Law of One material, over 1,500 channeling transcripts, publications, interviews, speeches, and more, and the community website bringforth.org. That's bring the number 4th.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question, please visit bringforth.org and go to Forum 2 and post to the thread Discussion Q&A with Carla L. Record submitting questions. And we always welcome live callers, so don't be shy. Go ahead and call in, and we'd love to have you join the discussion. We are here every Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Have a great week. See you then.